You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. When you think about retirement, do you have a strategy to help your money last as long as you do? That is the biggest fear by far for women. To help make sure you're ready for the future, schedule your complimentary wealth checkup at planefe.com/hermoney.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Evaluate how your relationship with money is tied to your childhood and how you relate it to achievement and what counts as enough and what did you actually feel like you lacked, and try to recall how your parents spoke about it. What did they care to spend on? And think about how like you're repeating those patterns or not.
Hey everyone, I'm Jean Chatsky. Thank you so much for joining me today on Her Money. So I know we're into 2024. I can't believe I'm even saying that. But let's just flash back on the fact that 2023 was the year, it seemed, of women unapologetically standing in our power. Just look at Taylor Swift. Right? Great example. 2023 was the year of Swiftonomics, the Taylor Swift effect. She generated so much revenue and tourism and jobs in the cities where she performed, including right here in Philly, where I lived, so much so that the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia actually weighed in on that fact. And one research firm estimated she had a $5 billion impact on the economy overall. But she's also been hailed as an icon for promoting fair living wages for her team, for doling out $100,000 bonuses to her trucking staff. Clearly, Taylor Swift adored by millions of fans around the world. But she also is someone who I love because she's poked fun at her haters. She has just thrown it right back at them. I mean, you can hear it in her lyrics, in Antihero, the lyric, I'm the problem, it's me, and Karma, where she says, karma for her is a good thing and asks, aren't you envious that for you it's not? And of course, the fans go crazy for it. Well, Betches Media took a little bit of this idea that we should all celebrate being called powerful bitches, reclaim that word, and created an empire out of it, actually. The site started in 2011 as The Betch List, a constantly updating list created by three college roommates that described the loves and hates of any woman-identifying human ballsy enough to call herself a betch. Fast forward 13 years, it is now the most influential female-focused humor brand on the market. The founders have been featured in many places, including Forbes 30 Under 30, and the brand was recently acquired for $54 million by Lad Bible this past October. Joining me today, co-founder and chief creative officer of Betches Media, Sammy Sage. Sammy has been credited with turning Betches into a social-first brand and tapping into a Gen Z audience, including my daughter, Julia, who, when I said we were having you on, said, Sammy's coming on. The brand now has over 1 million followers on TikTok. Sammy, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. That is such a flattering introduction. I really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, it's a pleasure.
Thank you. I mean, I will say I'm a huge Swiftie, and last year was so influential in how I thought about money and how women are marketed to, or really not perhaps marketed to. You know, this is just such an appropriate introduction in terms of everything I've been thinking about and reflecting on lately.
Well, what has been top of mind for you when you've been thinking about women and money?
Well, what's top of mind for me right now is that I think there's still such a strong misalignment between who is making, just in the aggregate, the decisions about marketing budgets and what demographics are deemed important and then how to approach them. And I think that those decisions are still not being made in alignment with the consumer habits. And by that, I mean women make more decisions about how more money is spent in this country than men do.
By a huge amount. I mean, we make 85% of the purchasing decisions.
Right. And I didn't even have that stat. I just knew that it was significantly more. And that is, I think, completely underappreciated. And the only reason that I can conclude is because the people deciding how money is allocated, which ultimately decides what happens, that just isn't in alignment with the consumer reality.
I agree with you. And I think that there is no place that is more true than in the financial services industry, right? Financial services was an industry that was started by white men, grown by white men, and is still largely controlled by white men. And I think you see that in a lot of the messages emanating from financial services companies. It's starting to change. It's not changing fast enough for me. But do you believe that 2023 was a bit of an inflection point, a tipping point that, you know, between Barbie and Taylor Swift and Beyonce and other cultural events, we are starting to see the landscape changing?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think that now at least these are the top line talking points. You know, like you'll have a panel at an influential advertising conference about how the Barbie economy has changed everything. And the irony, I think, is that it's not that anything has actually changed as much as the broader narrative around it. And I think that people who are smart marketers and smart business owners will take this insight and actually apply it going forward and not sort of get lost in the pendulum swinging back to, oh, women don't really spend that much money. You know, I think that the conversation, it will always have a reaction. But overall, I think what moves things forward over time is that money used to not be something that people spoke about, like, ever. And I still think there's a little bit of, like, people are like a little sticky about it, you know, a little bit euphemistic about it. And I think that one thing that has changed and should continue to change is transparency and honesty about finances. And I think there are reasons other than just like secrecy and privacy and convention that there's so much weirdness around it. And I think a lot of that goes to people's own personal psychology and relationships with money, which I think are sort of underaccounted for in the way we think about it. People think about it as like dollars in, dollars out, but money is hardly just a math equation. And there's so much more to this. So my feeling is that what's really shifted is that money is more prominent and allowable in the conversation. And I hope that's something that will continue to progress, because that is really what helps women in any sort of marginalized community around progressing with money.
I agree with you. I think that one big reason that money has remained so murky for so long is that the wealthy have a desire to stay at the top and keep others out, right? And perpetuate inequality. But I also think that it is not just numbers on a page. It's the psychology of how you view those numbers on a page, what it means to you, and how you react to it emotionally and psychologically. And that's something that we all need to understand about ourselves. And so having these conversations is one way to get there. You started Betches, as I said, with two college roommates. You started with Aileen Drexler and Jordana Abraham. For the listeners who don't know your story, I mean, one thing is, it's very clear to me that you understood that there was a need in the marketplace very early on as a young woman. Tell us your quick version of your origin story.
Yeah, so I'll say the three of us weren't just college roommates. We were also childhood friends. Like, I don't even remember meeting them because that's how like long our I do, but there's no like life in my mind that doesn't really have them in it. We were living together in college. Also, that was not planned from childhood. That was just sort of like circumstances and kind of playing out that way. And I think a commonality that we all share is we all grew up on Long Island in a very wealthy enclave that was extremely competitive and very aspirational. Like people move there because the public school is really good and their kids will get into Ivy League schools. And that was the backdrop in which we all grew up. Also, our parents, I think, each of their own origin stories, heavy immigrant roots, and all three of us are Jewish. And I think that imbued us with a lot of work ethic and a lot of creativity because we grew up around this environment. And ultimately, what we were doing when we were starting Betches was that we were trying to sort of satirize this generation and poke fun at it without hating it, but also without completely glorifying it. And the three of us bootstrapped this company. We've never taken investment so that when we did sell last year, the three of us owned 100% of it. I'll also say that just by the way, we did not sell for $54 million. We sold for $24 million with a potential payout of up to $54 million. I only make that correction because I feel like these are the types of conversations that I think need to be fluid and accurate and not be afraid to be addressed. It's public how much we made. And right. Rather than like, you know, I wish that wasn't a known thing, opening up the conversation and destigmatizing conversation is always something that I am very pro. And to your point about the way people think about money, I've actually started to think about this as like almost an attachment, the way there's attachment to, you know, in relationships. I do believe there's like almost an attachment theory for money. And it's something that's built very early. I think kids are aware about money and have a language around money before they're even like aware that they do. And I think it comes from how people around you talk about it, how they talk about getting it, how much they talk about it, what they talk about sacrificing for it. And when it comes to spending, like, do you hate to spend because like you feel that any money out is a loss? Or do you feel that like, oh, you spend this money, but you actually got something of value in return? And there's all these questions around like fulfillment and contentment and work ethic. And there's so much that goes into it. And I think that's not how people talk about it. They talk about it like a budget or just like a pie of numbers. And that's not, if you stick to that, you can move your finances in a certain way, but your relationship with money and how you feel about these things will not fundamentally change.
You're absolutely right. And if you haven't read The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel, you should 100% read that book because you are going to love it.
Oh, I definitely will. I will say like with having sold the company, it's a long road. You know, this wasn't an overnight thing where they're like, oh, here's the deal. There were calculations that went into the decision, but it was also like a decision that was based on more than just numbers. It was based on, do we want to have this be the sale after 13 years? Do we feel that this is the right value? Do we feel that the back end of the deal is a value that makes sense with the people we're selling to? And will we live in alignment with that? And will we like this relationship? And will it be good for the company? Will we be able to manage this company to A, have a good, smooth 3 years and not ruin our lives with it, which were good. And that's why we were sort of like, we don't need to sell this. We only want to do it if it's really going to be additive and worth the fair value.
Let me just dig in here for a second, because there are a lot of doors that you open, and I just want to make sure everybody sort of understands what happens when you sell a company. So when you sell a company, often, I mean, you and your co-founders, you are the value in this company. You are the ethos, you are the work ethic, you are the product. Nobody understands it the way that you understand it. And so they're buying your 1 million followers on TikTok, but they're also buying you. And often founders have to make a commitment that they will stay with the company for a certain number of years in order to see it through this transition. And so from the 24 million that you sold for to the 54 million that you could ultimately receive, you got to put in some work, essentially. And I hear from what you're saying, you're in for 3 years. Maybe you'll decide that you're in for more than that. You'll figure it out. But we have a lot of small business owners in our audience and a lot of wannabe entrepreneurs. What made you decide this was the right time? What made you decide this was the right acquirer? And what does it mean to you to stick with this for 3 more years?
I mean, I think, first of all, we wanted to give the company a chance at a legacy and to be a place where we genuinely want to stay past 3 years. Like, the dream is that we never want to leave. That's the best situation possible, or that we could take a sabbatical, come back, have a long-term relationship with our own company and keep building it. You know, like, that's something I'm very not just incentivized for the next 3 years to do, but genuinely care about. This is a great opportunity that is so rare. And we genuinely feel that it is additive to people's lives. Like, obviously, it's a business. Unfortunately, everything is a business. Even things you want to be totally helping professions, like a hospital, is very sadly a business. But we want to create something that really can help see people through their lives. So to your question about timing, you know, when we started this, we were really young. Maybe this wasn't something that we fully appreciated, but it was something we were conscious of, which is that we didn't have, this is the time to take a risk. This is the time to live in your parents' house for longer. And we're very lucky that we had the opportunity to do that and to have parents who were supportive of that. And so timing was a huge piece of it. We're now 12 years later, we're in early, you know, we're in like more middle adulthood. Yeah. I mean, it's weird to say it, but yeah, 34 and still saying it's weird to call myself an adult, but we're starting families. We're moving to homes. It's just a different phase in life. And honestly, if we hadn't had such a great experience with LBG Media, and this was like a 2-year conversation, if we didn't really have a lot of respect for the CEO, Sally Salamu, who is really just a very wonderful leader from everything that we've seen, we shared a vision, we shared sort of a sensibility, and we felt ultimately good about doing it and felt that the deal was fair and a good opportunity. And like I said, giving the company a chance at a legacy.
It's great to hear you talk that way, because we all know it can go both ways. I was a fan early on of a daily newsletter called Daily Candy, which was one of the very first internet newsletters. And your eyes are bugging out because you know where I'm going. New York Magazine bought it for millions of dollars and shut it down. And because they weren't integrating properly, they weren't able to see that vision and create a legacy. And I always thought that was such a shame, because it was a good brand, right? It was additive to people's lives and it had a good founder. And I felt like it could have had legs if it had been handled properly. There are a lot of people who are thinking these days about wanting to start their own thing, and also about how to shift with the times when your career shifts a bit, when money comes your way. I want to dig into both of those things. But before we do that, I just wanted to talk to our listeners for a second and remind you guys, we love you. We love our Her Money community. And we want to thank everyone who has listened to this podcast and reviewed the show. One of the listeners wrote recently, "Been listening and following this podcast since episode 1. Jean informs without sounding like an alarmist or sensationalistic. She chooses an array of guests that address each woman's individual needs and situations." And I'm just telling you this because we would like more reviews. So when you have a sec, please go on Apple Podcasts and write us a review. They really, really do make a difference. Do you have thoughts about this show that you'd love to share? Share with me. Well, it's time for our annual podcast and community survey. And personally, I'd love to know what you're thinking, because your feedback shapes everything that we do here. So please spend a few minutes sharing your thoughts. And as a thank you for your time, we are giving away Amazon gift cards and, of course, some other Her Money swag. Can't wait to hear what you think. Click the link in the show notes to take the survey. Her Money is proudly sponsored by Edelman Financial Engines. Whether your retirement is a few decades away or right around the corner, you need a strategy to help make sure you have enough saved and invested to do and see and experience what you want most. It's time to make sure your money is working for you. It's been more than a year now that I've been working with the planners from Edelman Financial Engines as the host of the Everyday Wealth podcast. I am a fan of their holistic approach, the fact that they don't just look at your investments, but at your whole life. You can request a complimentary wealth checkup at planefe.com/hermoney. We are back with Sammy Sage. She is co-founder of Betches Media. So, Sammy, we know that being an entrepreneur, starting your own thing, is a dream for a lot of people. What do you say to those women who are thinking, you know, I've got this side gig, it's going really well, maybe it should be my full-time gig, or I've got an idea that I think is a winner, should I go for it?
Well, I'll give you an answer that is very lawyerly, which is that it depends. This is the thing. There is no answer for any one person that I could give without speaking directly to that person and asking a series of various questions. And I'll say that ultimately what underpins all of this is you have to know yourself. You have to be honest with yourself about who you are, why you're doing it, what the odds are, where you are in your life, what could you jeopardize, what impact is this going to have on your family, and what could the payoff be? And by the time that payoff comes, will you have ruined your life by then? it's kind of the most dire way of looking at the question. Like, if you're someone who is a compulsive gambler and you look at the business you're starting like another gambling bet and you gamble your kids' tuition, you are kind of blowing up really fundamentally important things. And I think that those are the things that hold people back. Most people, they don't want to jeopardize either their relationship or their lifestyle or their time with their family or the time with their family at the present stage. And I think you also have to know the ins and outs of your business. Is there really demand for you to make this bigger? Are you the person? Do you know how to do it? Do you have the time? When you turn something into from a side hustle to a main hustle, are you going to get as much out of it as you do now? Like, maybe you like it because it's a side hustle and it gives you a little extra money. And when it's your lifeline, you might feel very differently about it. And you're doing it every day. And I also think right now there's a huge trend of like people monetizing their hobbies. That's very millennial and younger. Because, I mean, I'm not going to get into like the structural issues within, you know, how much young people make versus older people make, or, you know, all that generational stuff. But I do think there is sort of this like tendency to monetize your hobbies. And people tend to find that ruins the actual hobby, because you don't end up just doing that thing. If your hobby is pottery and you want to start a pottery business, you're actually spending a lot more time on like the administrative and the legal and your finances and setting up a shop and inventory and your website maintenance than you are the pottery. So like doing side deals with your friends to sell your pottery is probably fun and easy, and like maybe it could be a thing, but being Mrs. Pottery is like a different story. So it's, you know, there's all these calculations and you have to kind of know how to balance those factors.
I was flashing on how at one point in my life I thought that I actually might want to be a food writer. And so I went, because I love cooking and I love entertaining, and I went to cooking school, spent 6 months in cooking school, and came out knowing 100% that I did not want to be a food writer, because I just didn't want to spend my entire day doing it. Like, I like it because it's something that I do to unwind late in the afternoon or early evening, but getting up and having to do it all day, every day, totally not for me.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And even if you started like a little food blog and that could maybe make you a little extra cash, like that being your bonus versus it being your, oh, I have to do this. Now I'm living off this money a little bit and I rely on it. And, you know, it just, it brings it to a different place. So I think imagine all the possibilities, but also imagine not, you know, what it could really be.
You started your business with two lifetime friends, as you describe them. Is starting a business with friends something that you would recommend to other people?
I'm going to give the same lawyerly answer, which is that it depends. And it really, it simply does. I think it depends on the friendship. It depends on the person and you. And I think there are a lot of questions you could ask yourself, like, how strong is this trust and how much is it based upon? Again, we didn't start this as a business. So it's not like I said, oh, these are my two business partners. It's like, these are my friends and we figured out how to be business partners. And a business partnership, I will say, is more like a marriage than it is a friendship or a business partnership. There's three of us. Famously, groups of three girls, women, is, you know, very smooth. So I think, you know, we learned how to do that. We worked on that. And I think because we had this really strong foundation of trust and also our interests tied together, and we are passionate about this business, there was a lot that could, you know, a lot that we wanted to put the like love for each other and the trust over the growing pains. And 100%, no matter who the business partner is, in any situation like this, if your business is successful, you will go through periods of peaks and valleys, growing pains, times when you're irritated, times when you're seeing the absolute best in them and you're like, could not be more grateful for them. All I can say is that if you are willing to do the work to apply, to basically be in a second marriage, if you're married already, or the work you do put in to communicate in a healthy marriage is, I think, what you need to be doing in this relationship. And ask yourself, like, not only would you marry them, but would you divorce them? Then you have the question of the business of, do we believe in this business? Are we the right people? Should we get investment? Should we involve someone else? Should we hire someone and be the owners? You know, there's all these other pieces. So like, I would first, if you're, depending on how you're going about this, if it's like you want to ask someone to be part of it, or you start something, or it kind of just happens and you want to decide if you want to continue. These are sort of the dynamics that, and again, like what I said first, is none of this counts if you're not extremely honest with yourself. And again, it doesn't mean that all your answers have to be perfect. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be smooth. I see no problems. I think that you can be more certain in your own decision if you have admitted to yourself, there might be problems and they will probably be X, Y, and Z based on what I've seen in the past or what I'm seeing now. So looking at it and like, oh, there's no problems, I would actually question your decision more than if you said, I think we'll probably run into issues with these things and you've decided to do it anyway.
And we will handle them this way, or we're strong enough to handle them, eyes wide open.
Yeah.
$24 million is a lot of money. $54 million is a lot of money. They're both life-changing sums of money. How has this changed your life? How has it not changed your life? How does it feel to be a huge financial success?
I just have to be honest. It feels amazing.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that.
I will not put on any airs about it. Like, I am so happy with that piece. I'm not ashamed to say that, like, I care about money, you know, and I think more people need to be less ashamed to say it. However, I also have really worked on my relationship with money over years, and I am continuing to do that. A huge piece of this is evaluating your own relationship with money. What does it mean to you, in theory, to see $10 million in your bank account? Does that make you feel like, oh no, I can't spend it. I have to keep it. I have to keep trying to get more. Or does this make you feel like, wow, I can do X, Y, Z. I can do this. I'm going to save this amount. You know, do you feel the value of your money, or is it just sort of like this hypothetical thing you need to keep getting? And I will say that I've really worked to, even before this, because we were pretty financially successful before. We all were able to buy homes. You know, we live, you know, and I'll also say my husband contributes to this substantially. I was already living with everything I wanted, honestly. You know, obviously not every, you know, the most of everything, but like I was already very happy with what I had achieved financially and with the future prospects. Now I feel like just thrilled and I am motivated to earn more money, but I still feel the same level of contentment. But that's something I worked to feel and have really evaluated.
So as we wrap this up, and I could talk to you forever on this topic, I think that there are a lot of listeners who are going to want to know, how did you do that, right? I mean, there are a lot of people. First of all, I think you're talking to an audience of women who respect money, who are thoughtful about our money, who are not ashamed to admit that money is important and that money is an integral part of getting what we want out of our lives. But how did you get to this place in your relationship with money where you felt better about it?
So I would say there's a few pillars of this. One, it's that it's evaluate how your relationship with money is tied to your childhood and how you relate it to like achievement and what counts as enough. And like, what did you actually feel like you lacked? And think, try to recall how your parents spoke about it. What did they care to spend on? And think about how like you're repeating those patterns or not. Or what do you like about that? Like, what has helped you? Or what has like kind of made you feel not good? The second thing is that going to this like attachment theory, I've started to think about money as just, it's just energy. I mean, it's not just energy. I think about like people who are, you know, billionaires. At that point, it's not going to materially change anything. And the willingness to sort of give versus hoard is an energetic question rather than a numerical one. Here's some context to this. As much as I love to earn money, I also really love to spend money. And I love nice things. Like, I have no shame about that. And not just like to spend. I'm thoughtful about it, but I do love to spend money. And I also love to give money. My friends kind of joke that like, I would just like give away money for anything, but I also want to get it. So it's sort of this just like very, you know, loose almost feeling about it. And I think that is kind of like the energetic piece. It's like, I'm not afraid to like be very generous. I'm also not afraid to spend on myself, and I work really hard and want to get more, you know? And I think it's kind of like, are you really like anal about it? And sort of if you're a little too anal, loosening a little bit, and if you're a little too loose, being more careful and more judicious about how you spend or give. And I think you just want to kind of use all of those pieces to reflect and find a balance.
I hear in your examples and your story, I just hear an enjoyment of money that I don't often hear from the guests on this show. And it's actually really nice to hear.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I grew up in a family that was incredibly stressed about money. And it's almost like if money is a stress, it is a stress.
Oh, yeah.
And even when it was, you only add to it with your attitude about it. And again, that's like, I know, a very privileged thing to say, but I'm not talking to people who are really do not have the money. I'm talking about people who have it or have access to getting it and still are struggling with their relationship with it.
Yeah. Clearly an area that we can all work on a little bit. Sammy Sage, thank you so much for this conversation. I had a good time.
Me too.
Where can our listeners go to find out more about you, about Betches? I know they can go to TikTok, but where else would you send them?
You can go to Betches on Instagram at Betches.com. We have an amazing website, a number of Instagram accounts. You can find me on Instagram at Sammy, or on Threads, I use a lot, or on TikTok at Sammy Sage Says. And then I do a daily podcast called The Morning Announcements, where I break down each day's news headlines in 5 minutes-ish and add my own little commentary. And, you know, it's just a really easy, quick way to get the news that's light and not so scary and get it done.
Thanks so much for being with us. Before we dive into our mailbag, a very quick word from our sponsors. I wanted to, before we pick up this conversation, give you a quick sneak peek into what goes into our Investing Fix Club for women. Our Investing Fix Club is our stock picking club. We meet, Karen Feinerman and I and hundreds of women on Zoom every other Monday night. And as part of the program, women who are members have an opportunity to learn how to pitch a stock to the rest of the group. One of our members, Lorena, took advantage of this last month. She presented Oracle. And then the way the process works, the group votes on all the stocks that were teed up that month on which to add to the portfolio. Oracle won. So if you want to see why or see how this all works, join us for our next session. You can sign up at investingfix.com or at hermoney.com. And the first month is on us. Did you know that women are more likely to outlive our retirement savings than men are? It's true. In fact, it's our biggest financial fear. And this savings gap is where the Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity available from Gainbridge comes in. If you aren't familiar with annuities, the concept is essentially that you take a chunk of money and you turn it into a paycheck that you can start drawing on when you want to, next year or next decade. The Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity caters to women's unique retirement needs. And with a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal benefit and flexible withdrawals, it's like having a paycheck for life. Plus, you'll also get guaranteed returns at 5.95% APY, making the Parity Flex multi-year guaranteed annuity the perfect complement to your existing portfolio. So who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for important information. This is a paid endorsement.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's Ollie.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
And we are back for Mailbag. My daughter, Julia Chatsky, is with us. So, Jules, I got to ask, because I know everybody is wondering, how is the hard 30 going?
It's going. You know, some days are better than others. We're back on track.
How's it going for Adam?
How do you think?
He is like the most disciplined person I know.
It's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. Adam sets a goal and accomplishes it every single time.
Does he use any tricks or anything?
No,
or
that's he's just his. That's just him. He's just like, the sky will be blue today. The sky is blue today. I will lose 80 pounds. I lose 80 pounds. Like, it's ridiculous.
He's like that.
Yeah. Adam, every time we buy him smaller pants within a month, we have to buy him smaller pants.
Oh, my goodness.
I should really, you know, if anybody wants to start following me on a Poshmark for men's clothing, I'll be selling a lot this year.
Okay. All right. You let us know where to find you once you have set up shop.
Will do.
Did you know that our story on hermoney.com about where to sell, where and how to sell old stuff was our best ranking story of the year?
No, but I should read it. What was the outcome?
It was just 6 sites. It was 6 different sites where you could sell old stuff and make money. Poshmark was one of them. The RealReal was one of them. I tend to send a lot of stuff to the RealReal. Facebook Marketplace, I think. Maybe Kayo for furniture.
Yeah, Kayo. I'm always looking for furniture. You know, Adam is so disciplined, but he like makes a decision like letting me decorate our living room that we moved into in September. And he said to me in September, pick out whatever you want. Make this place feel like home. For background for the listeners, I moved into Adam's apartment where he used to live with a roommate. So I was very concerned it would feel like Adam's place and not ours. And we agreed on a budget because Adam works in finance, so he understands the need I need for a budget. Here's your budget. Buy furniture and make this feel like home. We're on month 5. I can't pick out anything. And Adam said, nope, this is on you. this is, I said to you, I would pick it all out and it would be done with. We would have had furniture by September 10th. And I'm stubborn.
But it would have looked like Adam's furniture if he had picked it out.
And hopefully, you know, Adam's fans aren't listening, but Adam's furniture taste is not, it's, you know, it's boyish and bulky and clunky, where I'm a little more West Elmy, if you will. So maybe by February, guys, I'll have picked out furniture. You know what is another one that I check? Apt Deco. Have you heard of Apt Deco?
No.
Oh, you actually should look at Apt Deco because it's fantastic and it's like resale furniture. But what I found is that a lot of stores have like a general manager of the store list all of their floor models. So on App Deco, there's a guy I always find, William S. and Daniel C. And they're clearly like general managers. One's of a Pottery Barn and one is of a West Elm. And you go through like all their pages of listing and it just says like floor model. And that's how it's tarnished because they have to sell the floor models at a discount. Fantastic. APTDECO.
Do they ship across the country?
Yes.
Okay. All right. We will check it out.
Now that we rambled,
let's get into our questions.
All right. Our first question today comes to us from Fran. She writes, "Hi, I'm trying to figure out if it's worth it for me to continue maintaining two American Express cards. The annual fee for the Delta Platinum card is $295, and it has a $27,000 limit. Now that Delta has made achieving elite status so difficult, I will likely never have it again. The other card is a gold card with a 99 annual fee and unlimited credit. It also gives 4x membership points for groceries and restaurants, which can then be converted to Delta miles for a small fee. I really don't need the Delta card anymore, but I am reluctant to cancel it because I know it will impact my available credit. On the other hand, I don't know what weight the credit reporting agencies give to a card with no limit. Help? Thanks again, Fran."
So Fran, this is a really interesting and good question. And the reason that it's interesting and good is because you have pointed out the difference here between a credit card and a charge card and how the credit bureaus treat credit cards versus charge cards. Your gold card, the Amex gold card, it's kind of a hybrid between a credit card and a charge card. The way a charge card works is you're not allowed to roll expenses from month to month. You got to pay off your full balance every month. Now, Amex has sort of played with that a little bit. They have something called a pay over time option, but the credit bureaus don't treat that gold card as a credit card. They treat it as a charge card. And what that means is that they are not factoring your credit utilization into your score. And it is a very important part of your score. So I would suggest that you hold on to at least one credit card. Your Delta Platinum card is a credit card. Now, you don't have to hold on to that card with its $295 fee. But what I would do is call American Express and explain to them that you no longer want this particular card, but you want a card with Amex with a lower annual fee. Ask them what they have available that they could roll you into. That way, you could preserve your long time standing with American Express, which is an important factor of your score. And you could preserve some semblance of this credit limit, if not the whole thing, which is important in your credit utilization. Then I would just keep an eye on your credit score and continue to use it in the right way. And a lot of people, because of these changes to mileage cards, are finding that really cashback cards are the ones that do them the most good. The cashback cards, because you don't have to earn enough to buy a free ticket that has become harder to get, cashback cards give you something that you can use all the time. Amex has cashback cards, so when you talk to them, maybe you want to see if you can convert into one of those. And I hope that's helpful. Okay, Jules, let's talk about your question. We'll make that the second question of the day.
Wow, lucky me.
So what specifically do you want to know about credit cards for couples?
Everything. Is there a card you recommend? Like, well, let's call my friends. Let's call them Lucy and Aaron.
Okay.
Do you know who it is?
Yes, I know them. Congratulations on their upcoming wedding.
Exactly. So I forget what I called them already, but L&A, they have two joint credit cards. They already had the credit cards, and then they got second credit cards that the other one can use. So they use like one of the cards for like all of their, like, they love to travel. So like all of their travel, and then they use all of their, the other credit card for like all of their like dining examples. And then I have other friends who opened up like checkings accounts, and they also like, the big hubbub is either like they, everybody wants the Chase Sapphire or an Amex. I have so many questions.
Here's the issue that you're not thinking about here, and it's actually the most important issue. It's very important for individuals to preserve their own credit rating and credit scores, right? Credit scores, you have a credit score and Adam has a credit score. You don't have a joint credit score.
Right. And part of the reason we're not ready to have a credit card is because my credit score isn't as good.
Okay. Let me come back to that credit score in just a second, because let me explain to you how it works. There used to be truly joint credit cards where both people were equal owners and users of that particular credit card. That's not the case anymore. One person is the primary user of a credit card, and another person is the joint or authorized user of that credit card. If couples have multiple credit cards on which one partner is not the primary user on any of them, it really hurts that person's ability to build credit. And so what your friends Lucy and Aaron have done, where each of them is the primary user on one and they made the other person the authorized user or joint user, that's fine. And in fact, by doing that, if one of them had a higher credit score than the other, sometimes you can piggyback on that person's credit score and it will help you build your own credit.
Got it.
When you were a kid and you got added to daddy's credit card, for example,
yeah,
right? That helped you build credit because you were piggybacking on his good credit. So if you got a credit card with Adam, it is possible that his good score could help you.
Got it.
Right? That's the major thing that I want you to keep in mind.
Okay.
But let's take this discussion, let's table it, and let's have a whole show where we talk about couples earning money. We'll invite your soon-to-be sister-in-law to participate in it with us.
Oh, boy.
And we'll get an expert on young people and finance to come in and talk about it with us.
Okay. Sounds like I just assigned Emily a task. Hopefully she's willing.
Hopefully she's willing, and hopefully you are still willing when the time comes.
Yeah. Caught me on a good day, I guess.
I guess so. If you've got any other money-related questions, we'd love to hear from you. You can send them our way by emailing us at mailbag@hermoney.com. And we're going to take a quick break. Hey, you guys, it's Jean. I want to tell you about another podcast I think you'll love because I love it, Freakonomics Radio. Every week, host and best-selling author Stephen Dubner dives into the hidden side of business and economics and so much more. He interviews CEOs, historians, even Nobel laureates to explore all kinds of topics like whether AI has a sense of humor and whether two CEOs are better than one. If you are curious like me and just looking to better understand the world around you, you will find it on Freakonomics Radio. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. We are back with your money tip of the week. A new study shows more than 60% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. It's true, even for people in higher income brackets. It's estimated that more than half of Americans earning over $100,000 a year live paycheck to paycheck. One of the reasons? Lifestyle creep, or the habit of spending more as your income increases. That's because people tend to hold benchmarks in their mind that if they reach a certain position or get a particular promotion, they deserve to buy certain things. And while I advocate treating yourself to little luxuries at least every once in a while, a great way to avoid this if you've gotten a promotion is to bump up your contributions to your 401k immediately. That way, extra savings will be coming straight out of your paycheck, and you won't feel like you're flush with all this extra cash at the end of the month. Your future self will thank you. For more timely money tips like this one, I hope that you're all subscribed to the Her Money newsletter. You can find it at hermoney.com/subscribe. Thanks so much for joining me today on Her Money. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our show at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review. We love hearing what you think. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Edelman Financial Engines. Her Money is produced by Haley Pascalides. This show is mixed and mastered by CDM Sound Studios. Our music is provided by Video Helper, and our show comes to you through Megaphone. Check out our new podcast, How She Does It with Karen Feinerman, for intimate cocktail party style conversations with today's most talented female leaders. This podcast is also part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. You can find us and other shows like us at airwavemedia.com. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk soon.